Welcome to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is James Wood, noted literary critic and novelist of a novel, The Book Against God, which is currently available in trade paperback from Picador. And it's a fascinating novel, and we're going to talk about that. First of all, Mr. Wood, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I was familiar with your criticism, and I thought when I began reading the novel, I thought it takes a certain amount of courage to be a literary critic and then venture into the world of fiction. And I'm kind of wondering, is this something that you'd been?
Well, I'd always wanted to do it, but you're right. There it takes a what in certain parts of England is called a bit of brass neck.
Yes.
That. There's the common idea, isn't there, that you can't write creatively and examine creative things as a critic. The old, teacher thing. Mm-hmm. He who teaches can't actually practice. I've never really understood that logic. If you said of someone, well, he's been living 7 years in France. It wouldn't automatically follow that person would be able to speak French. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And this is a rough analogy. But if you then said he's been 7 years in France, and that means therefore he won't be able to speak French, that would seem totally illogical. And I think something goes on in this idea that, well, he's a critic, therefore he won't be able to write. I mean, the logic ought to run in some ways the other way, which
That's
is...
That's what I would think.
Of course there are differences between the creative mind and the critical mind, and yet there are enough similarities. Many writers are themselves critics, whether published or not. I mean, you only need to get them in conversation.
Exactly.
They're scholars of their tradition, which is what a critic is. And any serious writer will tell you that what you need to do is simply immerse yourself in as many great books as possible, which is essentially what I've been doing for many years. But the psychological... part of your question is shrewd. I, like so many, dreamed of writing fiction when I was a teenager, and did start writing, continued writing into my early 20s. Then, to earn a living, and because I genuinely was excited by it, I started reviewing books immediately after leaving university, and got into the hurly-burly of that. And whenever I put pen to paper fictionally, after that, I was disappointed by what I had and chucked it away. And at some point around 27 or 28, I said to myself, well, you'll just have to be patient. You were quite precocious as a critic. I started straight away after university. You don't have whatever the precocious gene is for writing fiction. This was a time when one's own age group was beginning to appear in print in fiction and poetry. You don't have it. Maybe it'll come in the 30s. Just be patient. And so I did consciously put it aside for a while and came back at about 34, 35 to start writing it seriously.
You make a very good point. And this is something that I've thought of myself, is that at one point in time, I actually did a study of when most of the authors I admire, when they publish their work, and it's usually in their 40s and their 50s,
yeah,
that it really starts getting good.
Yeah.
And I think there's an impatience of aspiring writers to jump right into writing modern fiction without reading classics, without reading,
yes, yes,
the Dostoevskys and the Tolstoys.
Absolutely.
And
well, poetry is interesting because, and fiction, because poetry you do tend to get younger brilliances. I mean, Keats is an obvious example. Auden is another. These are people who were already quite fully formed in their 20s. Of course, Keats barely lived beyond the early 20s. Fiction, as you say, there's a great tradition. I mean, it seems to be a form that not only takes a great immersion, craft, and all the rest of it, but probably something like life wisdom, I mean,
mm-hmm,
experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you say, the examples, Stendhal, who didn't start writing until his 40s, Dostoevsky really comes into his prime in his 40s and even, mm-hmm, more so in his 50s, mm-hmm, as a novelist. That's quite true. It is much more of an old person's art. I mean, someone like Penelope Fitzgerald, a contemporary English writer, did not actually start publishing until she'd had a whole family, four children. Didn't start publishing novels until she was in her mid-60s. All the novels, the five or six novels that people now love her for, were published in the last 15 years of her life.
Hmm. If you would, for the listeners, I think sometimes the word criticism is misunderstood, and sometimes people think it's mean-spirited or that they misinterpret criticism with critical, and it's not mean-spirited. It is just an analysis of
yeah.
an author's work.
Yeah. I mean, criticism, as I see it, is as natural... it's as natural as language, because what it is at base is thinking about the art you are consuming. Criticism is simply a formal... There's a nice phrase that an American critic from the 50s produced, the formal discourse of an amateur. And I like that idea. I like that it is clearly formal because it's written down. It's a discourse because it has certain codes and conventions, but it's essentially the enthusiasm, whether positive or negative, of an amateur, of a lover of art.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no different in that sense from any ordinary person's comment when they see a work of art in a gallery, or come out of the cinema saying, thumbs up or thumbs down. It's obvious, it's human, that when we have this thoroughly human medium, art, that we will then want to produce a further dimension of talk about art.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what criticism is.
Yes, one of the books that we're going to talk about today is The Irresponsible Self, which is on laughter in the novel by James Wood. And in it, I think one discovers a sense of humor in classic fiction and modern fiction that sometimes people... It's like we've almost lost our sense of humor. It's hard for us to laugh at things anymore.
Well, there is that. I think there are a couple of things going on. One is that the idea of comedy, I think, has been somewhat hijacked by a certain notion of comedy. Something analogous has gone on in films, I think, where if you asked many people now... their idea of a comic film, it would be something, it would be some sort of gross-out film. It would be a very, it would be something about Mary or something like that. It would be a sort of lowest common denominator. I'm not saying these things aren't funny. I laugh.
Right.
I have a sense of humor like everyone else, but it'd be a certain kind of humor. The farcical, the zany, the wacky, the extravagant. I mean, extravagantly funny things. The idea, and I think actually, maybe just the age we're in. If you said to people, "What do you find funny in fiction?" they too would probably have an idea of the comic novel. The comic novel would be something like David Lodge changing places, maybe Evelyn Waugh, maybe P.G. Wodehouse or Catch 22. These are all funny writers, no doubt about it. Kingsley Amis, Lucky Jim. Campus novels, farcical.
Right.
It's not that I don't find those books funny. It's just that I'm interested in mining another scene, which is something closer to what we might call tragicomedy, where the comedy seems buried. It's milder when you can find it, and it's also immediately intermixed with pathos, with pain. I think that sort of comedy you can see going back to Shakespeare. King Lear is obviously one of the great tragic plays, and also oddly, painfully funny at certain times. Not just when the fool is on stage, but when King Lear, the old man, is at one point he's threatening one of his daughters, and he's hurling down curses on her, and then he stops and says, I know not what I will do to you. It always gets a laugh in the audience because it's such a true moment. I mean, we've all sort of, if our own fathers haven't exactly been like that, we know exactly that sort of impotent rage and literally sort of comically running out of curses. It's like, I'll do something to you. Shakespeare's very good at combining, I think, comedy and tragedy. And so I'm interested in discovering that where I can in fiction. Mm-hmm.
In your novel, The Book Against God, I found myself laughing out loud in certain sections. And the protagonist, Thomas Bunting, he's an interesting narrator because he really likes nice things, but he really has no ambition. And
no.
he's a bit maddening in that he's always working on finishing his PhD and his Book Against God. And at some point in the novel, you realize that this character is funny.
Yeah.
And I thought that it was very effective.
Well, I like the idea of a character who condemns himself. There's a technical term in fiction for this. It's not necessary really that anyone knows it, but I might explain it simply because I'll probably use it in a minute or two. And that's the idea of the unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, first of all, that a novel is being told first person, so the character is speaking straight to the reader. But that he should not be trusted for all the facts, therefore unreliable. What I like in fiction, I suppose I was trying to do this to some extent in my own novel, is where it gets really radically unreliable, and it's quite clear that a narrator is hopelessly revealing things about himself which he's not aware of at all, condemning himself when he thinks he's forgiving himself, absolving himself. So the kind of character that Thomas Bunting is exactly that, a sort of ne'er-do-well guy in his early 30s. His life is at a complete standstill. The reader can see that he'll never finish his PhD. And yet he doesn't seem to be able to do that at all. The reader can see that he's quite cruel to his wife. He doesn't see it at all. The reader can see that he's almost a lunatic about religion, that he's so obsessed with his parents, that the Christianity he's inherited from them and fighting it, that he's really going around in a daze and has lost a grasp of ordinary practical life. I mean, an example would be towards the end of the novel, he gets into terrible conversation, he denounces someone at a dinner table, and the question turns to atheists, and Thomas Bunting says, well, you know, it's actually been statistically proven that atheists divorce less than religious people. As he says this, he's about to be separated from his wife.
Yeah.
He doesn't know it. Yes. Actually, at that moment, the reader doesn't know it, although the reader has been thinking, this is highly likely.
How long is
this going to last?
Yeah.
So that would be an example. And you can get a lot of subtlety into that. It demands a little bit of patience from the reader.
Yes.
First of all, because, as you say, that character can often be maddening. And secondly, because you're encouraging them to look between things. You're not always giving it to them on a plate.
Yeah, there's a scene where Thomas gives the eulogy at his father's funeral, and it's painful. I mean, he stands up in front of a group of people in a church in a village where his father has been the spiritual leader, and he says, I'm an atheist, I'm paraphrasing, but he says, but those of you probably think Father's up in heaven reading his books. And finally, he's rescued or condemned, and it was a very difficult passage to read because
it's awful, isn't it?
Guy is just...
I know. He starts, it's the fate, the grandiloquence, and he's stuffing in illusions, and he's completely got his audience wrong.
Yeah.
He doesn't realize who he's talking to, and he's continuing a fight with his father. Actually, his wife says to him afterwards, that was meant to be a eulogy, but it looked like you were fighting the coffin. It's like you were having a struggle with your dad.
It was like he finally got somebody to listen to what he had to say, and what he really discovered was
nobody wanted to hear it.
Nobody wanted to hear it.
And I deliberately, in addition to the PhD, this vast project that Thomas Bunting is working on is actually called The Book Against God. It's a sort of book, of a commonplace book in a way, that he's been keeping very private and very secret to himself. And again, like the PhD, you can see that this is a complete white elephant. I mean, that it's this is something that is just weighing him down, a mirage and a bad idea. I deliberately, at the end of the novel, had him, incorporate into the terrible speech, the funeral eulogy, elements of the Book Against God to show the reader in a way that, you know, the Book Against God is a disaster in it, just the same way that the funeral speech is a disaster.
Yes. You're listening to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is James Wood. When we come back from a short break, I'm going to have Mr. Wood read a short excerpt from his novel, The Book Against God. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is James Wood, literary critic and novelist, and I've asked Mr. Wood to read an excerpt from his novel.
Music brought Jane and me together, but perhaps it, along with the PhD, drove us apart in the end. Jane once told me that talking to someone else who really understands music made her feel as if she had met someone of the same religious faith. She didn't mean me. I was a pagan, unable to pray with her. But it was lovely to touch the hem of that faith, to approach her single passion. In those early weeks after meeting her with Roger, it was very exciting to watch this passion, and to wonder about its force if it were ever shared between me and music. And that is what happened. When Jane realized my intentions, she responded to me as she treated her music, with ferocious seriousness and daily devotion. My own love suddenly seemed feeble in return, secondary. It was she who phoned me many times a day, her voice made small, made junior by the plastic receiver. She who left notes under the door at my dirty room in Bloomsbury. She was, in those days, superbly tolerant of precisely those characteristics which would later frustrate her. She seemed to be amused by the squalor of my Bloomsbury room, in a flat I shared with a very neat Indian scientist who penciled his initials on his eggs so that I wouldn't steal them. She used to tease me for my musical incompetence, and I happily failed four of her five tests of musical ability. These were in ascending order of difficulty. Could I recognize a piece of music a week after I had first heard it? Could I recognize what century a piece belonged to? Could I sing, without losing the note, a simple tune such as a hymn? Could I sing, without losing the note, a more complex tune, such as the viola's opening theme in Bartok's concerto, or the violins in Glazunov's, or a difficult Beatles song like The Fool on the Hill? She loves the Beatles. Finally, could I sing the bass part to a simple tune such as the National Anthem? I passed only the first test. I recognized a passage from Rosenkavalier when she played it to me a week after taking me to hear it at the Colosseum, because a fat man next to me had shaken with tears during the passage and had made the whole row of seats move slightly in sympathy.
Thank you. I love to hear writers read from their work. I think it gives it an intimacy that's maybe tough to get when you're just reading. Down the road from the passage you just read, I, as a bibliophile and a person who has been a collector for a long time, we sometimes come across these strange things called advanced uncorrected proofs and galleys and advanced reading copies of first editions, and a lot of times they'll have a sticker on them, and it says advanced uncorrected proof. And Thomas's father, Peter, has done something kind of interesting with one of his stickers. And why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Thomas's father, a minister, has reviews books for a theological journal, so he gets advanced copies, as you were saying, of books. And one of the stickers that you sometimes get on advanced copies, when it's not a proof copy, it'll be just an advanced copy, and it'll say, "This is an advanced copy sent in lieu of a proof." In other words, they cut out the proof; they just sent the finished copy, but it is an advanced copy several weeks ahead of publication. Thomas's father has taken this sticker, this is an advance copy sent in lieu of a proof, and stuck it onto one of his Bibles. And I offered that as, or Thomas offers it as I suppose, an example of his of something that is probably rarer than one imagines among vicars, which is a sense of humour and a sense of theological humour, an ability to tease himself in a way about the existence of God or the verifiability of the existence of God. One of the psychological tensions that I wanted there to be in the novel quite strongly is that Thomas the son is damned in a way because, or doomed perhaps I should say, because his father does everything he does better. His father is spiritually more competent in a way. I mean, Thomas spends his time raging about religion, his father simply gets on with it. He's much better humanly. I mean, he's loved by his parish, he's pastorally successful. Thomas is a complete mess. Thomas spends his time raging about suffering, and it's why he doesn't believe in God. But I want to make the point in the novel that it's completely theoretical in a way. I mean, he hasn't actually had much experience of suffering. Mm-hmm. It's all got from books. Mm-hmm. Thomas's father, again, knows something about suffering, has actually lived. I mean, he's fought in the war. He sees it in a daily way. I mean, he deals with death every day, buries people, and so on. And finally, Thomas's father is also more intellectually flexible, and this ability, what I wanted to get across, this sense of humor that he has, this ability to tease himself, to mock himself, to be flexible, undogmatic, is something Thomas could really learn from if he could only get through this awful Oedipal conflict that he has and see his father for the admirable figure he is.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the term unreliable narrator. Mm. And there are times when we see Thomas, there's a scene where his parents are, his father's kind of caring for him when he's having a difficult time, and then his mother makes a comment, and he says something along of the lines of, mother, was St. Ignatius really, was he really a big weeper? And they just kind of like forget about Thomas for a minute. And in that moment, you realize that his parents really have had a very isolated life. And
yeah.
And he really has, though they're great parents, he probably has not had a lot of nurturing, perhaps. Or we question, what kind of nurturing did he get? Because
yeah.
That scene really shows you that they kind of checked out on him when...
I did want to get that sense that someone reviewing the book in Britain... quoted a line which I didn't know from Robert Louis Stevenson, something to the effect that the orphan is not more alone than the single child of very, very happy parents.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little overdone, but I did want to get the sense that that he's a single child and that it's been a great marriage. I mean, that, of course, is the other thing that his dad can do. He can pull off a great marriage, clearly what Thomas can't do. But that there has been perhaps a too great interest, a codependence in each other that mother and father have, which they haven't always lavished on their son.
Yeah, I love that line. I've not heard that before.
It's a good line, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, there's another thing worth saying about it. This probably... This makes it sound too theoretical in a way, and I suppose it's the danger of being a critic that I can read my novel as if I was reading someone else's. But there is this interesting strand, I think, in atheism, and Thomas is an atheist, that the theological arguments are always get messed up by often frankly Oedipal. I mean, there's something Oedipal about atheism generally, because it's about slaying the father. I mean, literally the father in heaven. It's about throwing off, and you find again and again among the sort of celebrated atheists, probably the best known is Nietzsche, whose father was a Lutheran pastor. You see again and again that, and in addition to the genuine intellectual content that these atheists bring to the struggle. It's also there's also this unmistakable son-father thing, and I wanted to get just a hint of that.
Yeah, there are references to Schopenhauer in the book, and he doesn't do too well in some of the conversations, which is kind of interesting. Some interesting twists because Thomas is throwing it up as proof of his theories.
And I know.
When you read it, it's kind of like,
I know, awful stuff. And then his wife just says, "I don't care what Schopenhauer said.
Right.
I want to know what you think." That's right.
Right. You mentioned a few minutes ago, you mentioned cinema. And in The Irresponsible Self, one of the essays is on Tom Wolfe and A Man in Full, a novel which I could not believe was nominated for a National Book Award and has received the acclaim it did. And when I read some of the reviews that you state early on in the essay, it really is pretty incredible what some people were saying about that novel. And when you look at the history of literature, it really makes you wonder how many books it's actually read. And that when you're talking about the fiction and cinema, it seems to me that novel was just about everything that's bad about trying to write for the screen or being so literal about that type of thing. It's almost like subtitles almost to a film or something.
It's true. It's worth saying about Wolfe that he produced a sort of manifesto for Harper's Magazine in the mid-80s.
Yes.
In which he expressly said, you know, there isn't enough journalism in American fiction. We need to go out and report more, take down notes, and bring back the goods, bring back the information about American society. And I remember reading that when it came out and feeling that in some way that the subtext wasn't really journalism, it was cinema, as it so often is in those kinds of literary manifestos. There was a similar one just a few years ago produced in Britain by a couple of writers who said that fiction should be simpler, we should get rid of flashbacks, that each story should be time-dated and so on. Often you'll find that the struggle that's really going on is a struggle with cinema, to take some of cinema's power and you know, genuine power in realism, and bring it into fiction. The problem is that what you then get is something that doesn't have, I think, a really literary dimension anymore. And you see that with Wolfe. The characters are simply built up from the outside. What's so surprising is that when people look at Danielle Steele or Jackie Collins or so on, they can see perfectly well that sort of thing is going on. They'll say, you know, well, it's pretty flimsy the way that she tags each character by, you know, a Louis Vuitton bag or whatever. They don't seem to notice that actually at only a slightly higher level, the same thing's going on in Wolfe. It may not be the Louis Vuitton bag, but it's you know, carefully chosen social data that will give us a picture, which of course always ends up as a stereotype. It has to. And I feel quite evangelical about criticism when I'm reviewing that kind of book, because it's why I'm sort of unfashionably judgmental, because I feel that it's important to say to readers, watch out, you're being cheated. There are people, including of course Wolfe himself, who want to pass this off as the genuine article. But if you read it and spend a month of your life reading it and then convince yourself that that's the genuine article, you'll be missing out on something that can bring a great deal of more pleasure, solace, depth, complication, and so on into your life.
Yeah, Danielle Steele, I think you pretty much know what you're going to get when you put down your money, and that's what you want.
Yeah.
I agree wholeheartedly with what you say. And in The Irresponsible Self, you mentioned a couple essays on classic writers who thankfully are enjoying a renaissance of sorts, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and Anna Karenina is being read in greater numbers now, since Oprah Winfrey has selected it to read. And in your responsible self, if you enjoy Anna Karenina, which I imagine you will, there are some very interesting comments, I think, on the characterization in that essay.
Well, I love Tolstoy. It's hard to find any writer who doesn't have great respect for Tolstoy, in part because, you know, we were saying a minute ago about the realism that we feel when we're at the cinema. Tolstoy has that. I mean, all writers and all ordinary readers feel it too. When Anna Karenina or A War and Peace really gets going, that these scenes are presented to us with the utmost naturalness, full of life. Somehow, Tolstoy manages, it's an extraordinary combination to be both simple and complex at the same time. I mean, that's one of the reasons I think why he translates so well. It's not a complicated prose. And there's a kind of simplicity that I think, it almost seems Homeric, actually. I mean, when you think of the great scenes in Tolstoy, battle scenes, the peasants threshing in the fields, horse racing, these are vast, you know, vast canvases. And yet, as you were suggesting in your question, character, the human, is paramount for Tolstoy. And in that sense, I mean, Anna Karenina is interesting. He starts the novel wanting to write a much more moralistic, condemnatory kind of book, which will come down hard on Anna the adulterer. He finds he can't do it. As he's writing the novel, as he's creating the character of Anna, so he, like the reader, is inevitably drawn into a sympathy with her. And by the time that Tolstoy is finishing writing the book, she's a much more independent, self-willed, human, sympathized with character. So that we're, rightly so that we can feel the loss when she throws herself under the train. But it's an interesting... it's an interesting example of how ideally the novel ought to work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In your essay on Dostoevsky's God, one of the phrases that really struck me was you wrote, "Pride and humility are really one," and I found that very kind of jumped off the page at me. If you would,
Well. It may be that what it's talking about, a certain kind of pride and a certain kind of humility. I suppose what I meant was that there is a kind of there's a kind of fake humility, I suppose, which actually is the humility that probably about 90% of humble people actually have. I mean, the truly humble are very hard to find. Yeah. So there's a kind of fake humility which actually is very, very close to pride. Because the fakely humble person, I think, is always secretly, privately congratulating himself for being more humble than anyone else. Congratulating yourself is a form of pride. It's why fakely humble people are very anxious about where they are in the pecking order. Proud people, or insecure proud people, are insecure, I think, for similar reasons, that actually... At some level, an anxiety is gnawing away at them, and the anxiety that's gnawing away at them is that they're not perhaps quite as top-notch as they pretend to be. Therefore, in some ways, actually, they're infected with the virus of humility. So that's and you find in Dostoevsky that he does this with characters, that he has these extraordinary characters in several of the novels who veer wildly between appalling displays of arrogance and revolting displays of abjection and pathetic begging and sort of snake-like humility, generally in order to get something from the person that they're interacting with. Dostoevsky is very strange because the reason he speaks, I think, still to us is that we go to Dostoevsky and we're still, I mean, you know, every 20-year-old student who reads Dostoevsky the first time is always blown away because they say to themselves, I didn't know character could be as wild as this in the novel. It's completely outrageous.
Especially somebody wrote that long ago.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. Well, that's the thing.
When you're 20, that's...
And it makes...
this old Russian guy.
Yeah, this old Russian... And it makes Dostoevsky eternally modern. It really does.
One of the things I'd like to leave the listeners with is I always like to introduce good books to read, which The Irresponsible Self and The Book Against God by James Wood both fall into. But if we could, I'd like to end it, because you mentioned the novella of Dostoevsky's, which is a favorite of mine, The Eternal Husband. And so perhaps we can give our listeners that have read some of Dostoevsky's novels but perhaps haven't read The Eternal Husband, what is it about The Eternal Husband, the novella, that really, as a critic, drew you to that?
Well, I should just say that The Eternal Husband is this extraordinary short novella about a man from the provinces who discovers that years ago his wife had an affair with a man in Petersburg, St. Petersburg. His wife has died, and that's how he's discovered, he's come upon some letters, although we don't know this. He goes to St. Petersburg to find the man, an old friend, who had the affair with his wife, and basically to stalk him. I mean, that's the term we would use nowadays. What he does in an extraordinarily Dostoevskian way is circle around him, teasing him with this knowledge, so that the seducer, the man from St. Petersburg, is constantly thinking, how much does he know? How much does he know? Does he know? I think he knows. If he knows, why is he here? What is he doing? And typically in Dostoevsky, the interest moves quickly away from where it would be stuck if a thriller writer were doing it, or say a Hollywood film. In a Hollywood film, it would be stuck simply at the instrumental or strategic level. Does he know? What flows from that? The Dostoevsky is a much deeper level, which is precisely, if he knows, why is he? What curious, warped satisfaction is it giving this man to stalk the lover? Why has he come to Petersburg to make hell for this other man? And the verdict by the end of the book, both Dostoevsky's and the lover's, is that this cuckolded husband has come because he both hates and admires the seducer. That he hates him in a way that any man would for having this affair, but that in some way he's almost jealous of his sexual prowess, that he wants to be in his presence. And as this man decides near the end of the book, he decides that he's come to St. Petersburg to hug him and to stab him in the back at the same time. And there we have the great example of the wonderful, mad, contradictory nature of Dostoevsky and psychology, and yet it seems to me a reading of human nature that's absolutely accurate.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Our guest today has been James Wood. Mr. Wood, thank you for your generous time, and I wish you the best of luck as time goes on.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.